From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Buffalo Bills blew four straight Super Bowls. The New England Revolution were losers in four MLS Cup finals, including three straight. Ahead on Only a Game, will Northwest Missouri State lose its fifth straight Division II football title? Also, Kenyon College's swimming dynasty pushes into its fourth decade, and the latest dishes from the Hot Stove League. Also ahead, the 17th annual Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide.
The Snuggie almost has like a cult following. People love Snuggies to begin with. Now you put a Snuggie and a college logo together, and it's just taking it up a notch.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. After the Fall Classic, but before the boys of summer bounce into spring training, Major League Baseball executives make a cold weather grab for our attention by convening for their winter meetings, which concluded Thursday in Indianapolis. Joining us now to discuss the meeting's winners and losers is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great talking to you, Bill.
Before we get into the top trades to come out of the winter meetings, we need to take care of some unfinished business. This is the first time that you and I have spoken since the World Series concluded, and in the name of fairness, we have a clip that I would like to play for you.
I wavered a little bit after they barely showed up for game one, but I'm sticking with the Yankees in seven because I'd like to be right, Bill, for once. I'm not sure that's ever really...
Now, the Yankees actually ended up winning in six games. Still, we would like to give you credit where credit is due, so go ahead and gloat if that's what you want to do.
Bill, I'm never going to gloat. And as I've told you many times on the show, I never apologize for being wrong because it speaks to the beauty of the game when the guys who cover the game every day for a living miss it by as much as some of us, including myself, miss it by. So if I'm never going to apologize for being wrong, I am never going to gloat when I'm right.
Speaking of the Yankees, New York made one of the most notable deals of the meeting, sending pitchers Phil Koch and Ian Kennedy along with a prospect to Detroit for outfielder Curtis Granderson. Who made out better, the Tigers or the Yankees?
Well, for the short term, the Yankees certainly did. They've been looking, Bill, for the last few years to get more athletic, become a better defensive team, and now Curtis Granderson will help solidify the outfield defense because he allows the center fielder, Melky Cabrera, to move to left field, replacing Johnny Damon. Now, that doesn't mean Detroit got nailed on this deal. It didn't. The Tigers are in trouble financially. They had to move on some salary, which they did with Curtis Granderson and Edwin Jackson. They added four younger, more affordable players for the future. This could really help the Tigers, but there's just no way around it. It weakened them for 2010.
There is a lot of interest in free agent outfielders Jason Bay of the Red Sox and Matt Holliday of the Cardinals, but neither has signed at this point. Where are they likely to end up?
I still think Jason Bay is going back to the Red Sox. Now, that doesn't mean that the Mets, who are absolutely in deep, deep trouble here and need a bat so badly, especially a corner outfielder like Jason Bay, that they're going to make a pretty big push for him because they have to. The Red Sox are in trouble on their own. They've got the Yankees in front of them. Yankees are World Series champions, as I predicted. And
wait a minute. That sounded suspiciously like gloating.
Close to a gloat. Sorry about that. And the Red Sox know that the Yankees got even better in the offseason with Curtis Granderson. So it's my feeling that the Red Sox will say, we need Jason Bay, and they will pay him enough money to sign him. If, however, he signs with the Mets, then the Red Sox are going to have to turn to Matt Holliday.
Angels pitcher John Lackey is also a free agent, and the Toronto Blue Jays are still talking about trading Roy Halladay. Any predictions on where those two aces wind up?
Well, there's an outside chance they're both going to end up with the Angels. First with Lackey. I talked to Mike Socha, the Angels manager, at the winter meetings, and he made it absolutely clear that pitching is their number one priority, and their number one guy is John Lackey, since he came up through their organization and won Game 7 for them in the 2002 World Series as a rookie. So my guess is still John Lackey is going back to the Angels. Now, Roy Halladay is much more complicated. The Angels have made an offer for Halladay with real players involved, and apparently it's not going to be enough to make the deal. However, the fact that they're even talking about this deal, to me, makes them the front runner for Roy Halladay.
Red Sox owner John Henry has expressed concerns about how the smaller market and less successful teams are spending the money that they get from the luxury taxes levied against the big spenders like Henry's Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers. Will anybody listen?
People will listen, Bill, and this will be a big factor at the next labor negotiation. Big market teams have been crying something like this since the day revenue sharing began. What are you doing with the money that we are giving you out of our pockets? And that's something that is very difficult to prove. Exactly where is that money going? And that's what John Henry was trying to say. Show me that the money I'm giving you is going towards your ball clubs.
All right, Tim, are there other teams that you and I should be talking about in terms of interesting moves that may still be made?
The two teams you have to keep your eye on right now are the Cubs and the Dodgers. The Dodgers have virtually no money to deal with, I'm told. They have several holes on their club that need to be filled, and yet the much-publicized divorce between Frank McCourt and his wife have caused all sorts of financial issues, I'm told, with the Dodgers, and they can't just go out and be major players in free agency or via trade. The other team is the Cubs, under new ownership, that have some money to deal with, but their first order of business has to be to trade Milton Bradley, their really difficult outfielder who gave some of their players such a hard time. I think he'll get moved to Tampa Bay pretty soon here, but that's got to be their first move. A lot of work needs to be done with the Cubs.
All right, Tim, you can't rest on your laurels forever, so let's have you pick next year's World Series participants at least. No, I'm kidding. We'll let you enjoy
Bill,
your
it's
success.
December the 12th. What are you, crazy? Can I just not rest on my laurels for 2 weeks before I have to make a pick again, please?
Fair enough. Tim Kirkchian covers baseball for ESPN, and he joins us regularly to talk about same. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me, and happy holidays not only to you but to all of your family.
And you too, Bill. Thanks very much.
Today in Florence, Alabama, the Northwest Missouri State Bearcats face Grand Valley State University for the 2009 Division II football title. The Bearcats have made a record 5 straight trips to the championship game, but they've lost the previous 4. The team insists they're not worried about becoming college football's Buffalo Bills equivalent. Really? Only a game's Greg Eklund has the story.
First things first. The last name pronunciation of the Bearcats head coach, spelled T-J-E-E-R-D-S-M-A, is Churchma.
It's a Dutch name. The Dutch, we were in Holland a couple of years ago, and the Dutch don't have any problem with it. They pronounce it Schiertsma, but it has been Americanized.
Most of his friends just call him by his first name, Mel. The Bearcat players address him as Coach T. No matter how you say it, Churchma has been a pronounced fit for the Bearcats since 1994. After Northwest Missouri finished 0-11 in his first year there, the Bearcats haven't had a losing season since. In 1998 and 99, the Bearcats won back-to-back national championships. That third title, however, has eluded them. With losses in 4 straight championship games before the season, Churchma says he still hasn't felt compelled to summon Marv Levy, who coached the Buffalo Bills to 4 straight Super Bowls without winning.
Well, Marv never won one, so we won a couple. So, no, I haven't worried. We really don't worry about that. We put all our emphasis on the present season.
Maryville, a town of almost 11,000, sits about 30 miles south of the Iowa-Missouri border. Here on Main Street, traffic runs past the county courthouse. The Northwest Missouri campus is a 5-minute walk to the west. Maryville will truly be a title town this year if the Bearcats win the football national championship. Over Thanksgiving weekend, the town's high school team, the Spoof Hounds, won the 2009 state football championship. The Spoof Hounds are coached by Bearcats alum Chris Holt. He was an undergraduate at Northwest Missouri when Churchma first arrived in Maryville. Holt says those lean years aren't forgotten.
My last year at Maryville, Mel didn't win a game, and that was his first year. So it was the following year that they were like 6-5, and then of course the rest is history. So even my last year of college, you know, the Bearcat football wasn't much there.
Now, as a high school coach, what does Holt feel is the key ingredient to making Churchma successful at Northwest Missouri?
The family atmosphere. You know, we try to do the same thing here with our program. Our kids are really tight, and so is our coaches. And I think that's the reason we have the success that we do. And I know that's the reason the success that they have out there, because you really feel like you're a part of something. And I think once you establish that, kids want to play for you.
Senior Division II All-American free safety Miles Burnsides is one of two Bearcats defensive starters who are homegrown from Maryville. His father, Mark, played football for the Bearcats, and Miles attended games with his family as a fan growing up. Playing for the Bearcats fulfills his dream.
Definitely. I mean, just growing up in the tradition and seeing the community and how they support the Northwest football, it's just something I couldn't pass up, I guess. I just wanted to be part of the system.
The Bearcats have had their shaky moments this season, but after a season-opening loss at Abilene Christian in Texas, they won 12 straight going into last week's semis. They've also continued their streak of 37 straight wins in their conference. Burnsides and nine other seniors have made four trips to the championship game, first as redshirts and then as eligible players. Last weekend, they earned their fifth with a semifinal win over California of Pennsylvania, thanks to a key touchdown to close out the first half.
Cal's had two punts blocked this season. There's the snap, and they go after it, and it is blocked. It's blocked away by Roberto Davis, picked up on the right side by Creason. Touchdown, Northwest!
After a 21-10 halftime lead, the Bearcats blew the game open in the second half en route to a 56-31 victory. A Florence dignitary conducted the post-game formality with Mel Churchma, who responded with a guarantee.
On behalf of the NCAA Division II Football Committee, the show's National Championship Committee, I want to issue an invitation for you to win the National Championship in Florence next week.
We accept it. We're going to win it too.
The Bearcats are aware that, because of their streak of four straight championship game losses, they've been associated with the Buffalo Bills, who went to and lost four straight Super Bowls from 1991 to 1994. Defensive end Sean Paddock says it's talked about among the players, but only in certain places.
I'd say more so just at home with each other than actually out at practice and stuff, because we understand that, you know, I mean, you can have that in the back of your mind, but if you focus on that and don't focus on the task at hand, you're not going to get there. But, I mean, talking about it amongst each other, it's just that's all it is we got to get it done this year. It's our last crack.
Today, the Bearcats will meet the Lakers of Grand Valley State of Grand Rapids, Michigan. They're also 13-1. After four straight title game losses, a win for the Bearcats would finally put to rest being linked with the Bills. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Maryville, Missouri.
You ain't nothing but a Bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You ain't nothing but a Bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You can purr, pretty kitty. But
it's 19 minutes past the hour. Several volunteer members of New York's Office of Emergency Management briefly saw red on Monday night, but it was the man they captured trying to rob a diner with a paintball gun who ultimately got the blues. The alleged perpetrator, Carlos Abreu, also wore a paintball mask, presumably in case the owner of the diner was also packing paint. If this had been a 40s gangster film, the perpetrator might have been characterized as a yellow rat by James Cagney. Orange, you glad I thought of that particular stretch? Green with the envy he felt of more successful stick-up artists, Mr. Abreu was later arraigned on what must have been a gray day for him.
Paintball, 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 ball, 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 ball.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a beautiful game, but not the beautiful game. But first, here are some of college sports' most impressive dynasties. UCLA's 10 NCAA crowns in men's basketball during the 1960s and 70s, the University of North Carolina's 21 women's soccer titles over the past three decades. How about Ohio State's 25 national championships in synchronized swimming? But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter found last month when he visited Gambier, Ohio, the Kenyon College swimming team has the most impressive title run of all.
In 1975, swimming coach Jim Steen came to this rural college with its strong undergraduate programs and Ivy League-ish stone buildings after working 2 years as a graduate assistant for the Miami University swimming team in Oxford, Ohio. 5 years later, he led Kenyon's Division III program to the first NCAA championship in its 45-year history.
I was fortunate to be selected for this job here and thought I would be here 4 or 5 years and maybe move to the big time if we were successful here, and I discovered that Kenyon is the big time.
Steen stayed on to start a family and an unlikely winning streak, an NCAA record 30 straight Division III men's swimming titles and counting. The 30-year-old women's team, which Steen also coaches, has won 23 crowns of its own. Greg Perini is the coach at neighboring Denison University and a Kenyon alumnus who swam on Steen's early teams. He calls Kenyon's championship collection staggering, especially since more than 200 Division III schools compete in swimming.
I think there's a remarkable consistency there. I mean, I think that there's been a consistent message there over the years, and I think it starts with Jim. And I think Jim has been absolutely relentless in terms of his approach towards providing kids with a program that embraces excellence in the classroom as well as in the pool.
Kenyon's athletic director, Pete Smith, says the swimming program continues to live up to the standards it set 25 years ago when he coached Division III rival Emory University.
You'd heard all the rumors, you'd heard all the background stories, and then they came in for real life and they performed phenomenally well. The team just seemed to be a little better prepared than everybody else, a little more focused, extremely competitive. We would say, oh, they look like a Division I team. You know, they look like they're a scholarship team. Well, they're not.
Smith leads the way around a stunning $70 million glass and steel complex that opened in 2006 and could be called the athletic center that Kenyon Swimming helped build.
The laser-cut steel beams are really a work of art. So this is a combination of architecture with functional space.
There's a full-size track, small basketball arena, and four indoor tennis courts. On one wall, there's an honor roll of the school's All-American athletes, including more than 100 swimmers, with a few athletes from other sports sprinkled in. It's the sheer abundance of talent that usually lets Kenyon qualify the maximum 18 swimmers allowed for the NCAA championships every spring. And while Steen remembers some close calls during the men's title run, they've been few and far between. On this Friday afternoon, clad in their Kenyon purple swimsuits and caps, more than 60 men and women churn nonstop in 17 lanes, spanning the width of the gigantic pool that takes up almost a quarter of the athletic center. More than half of Kenyon's recruits consider joining Division II and even Division I swimming programs. They choose Kenyon, Steen says, to take a road, or in this case, a lane less traveled. They arrive without athletic scholarships to two-a-day practices and a mantra that there's no guarantee of another championship.
I don't think in any way our kids ever go in thinking it's a given. In fact, I think much the opposite. Our philosophy is that you start from a point which really suggests that you haven't accomplished anything. Certainly you haven't accomplished anything in this particular year. We kind of operate under the adage that it's always better to go from being a nobody to a somebody than to go from being a somebody to a nobody.
Steen constantly asks his swimmers to take chances and use their imagination during races. Sophomore physics major and freestyle specialist David Summers says he gets Steen's theory of success.
Coach has been here for 30-plus years.
Yeah.
And if he was doing the same thing he did when he won his first one, we wouldn't be that good anymore. Every year, coach is doing what's the newest and best training methods. And I think that's maybe the most impressive thing is that he doesn't get stuck in a rut. he keeps reinventing the team every year and finds some new way to do that.
And then the other thing you need to do is you need to let me know what your plan is and why you don't swim after weights.
For all the emphasis on the present moment, sophomore Kellen Caldwell, whose mother swam on Kenyon's first championship women's team 25 years ago, says that the burden of her team's success can be overwhelming.
Well, I think I fully realized it at Nationals this year when I looked up in the stands and saw, you know, the hundreds of alums. You really are swimming for something more than just the present team, more than yourself also. I mean, you're swimming for generations of people before you.
Kenyon's decades-old success story has caught the attention of more than its own swimmers and opposing coaches. Last year, Ohio State football coach Jim Tressel, himself an NCAA champion, arrived with his entire team to practice here and to compare notes with Steen. Kenyon athletic director Pete Smith remembers that visit well.
When Jim Tressel wants to come and find out what makes Jim Steen tick, I asked Coach Tressel, how's your sharing going? He goes, I'm not sharing with Jim, I'm listening. He's telling me things, I'm here to learn.
A new generation of college swimming coaches at Division III Powers Denison and Emory and Division I Louisville, to name a few, has also learned under Steen. Would one of those coaches, say Denison's Greg Perini, be the best candidate to take over when the 61-year-old master is done?
Oh, I could never answer that question because I don't think Jim is ever going to die. Jim's immortal. He's going to coach forever, I think. He's going to be the Joe Paterno of Division III swimming.
Last weekend, Kenyon's men finished first and the women second in the five-team Nike tournament they hosted in Gambier. They'll break for exams before taking on Division I North Carolina on January 5th. And they'll seek their next NCAA titles at the Division III championships in mid-March. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're a lot slower pace than they are.
Yeah, yeah.
You might want to move over in that lane.
Glance at an NBA game in progress and you will see enormous men conspiring with one another to either put a ball into a basket or keep the same ball out of a basket. But look more closely at that game, and if Chris Ballard is to be believed, you will see artists at work. Chris Ballard, who is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, is also the author of The Art of a Beautiful Game, the Thinking Fans Tour of the NBA. He joins me now from the University of California at Berkeley. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been a basketball player and a basketball fan for many years. When did it first occur to you that what basketball players do could be characterized as art?
Probably when I hit a level as a player and I played small college ball, Division III for a little bit, and I got to a point where I realized, okay, the basketball that I've been playing growing up and that I watch when I'm watching a game, which is often the ball. You know, you grow up, you watch the NBA, you watch college basketball, and whoever has the ball, you watch that player. And you say, okay, he either made that shot or he didn't. And that's sort of like your elemental introduction to watching the NBA. And then all these other elements are involved in this. And as a player, that kicked in for me. And then I started watching the game differently and saying, okay, I'm going to watch the guy off the ball, the guy on the far side of the court. What's he doing? And how important is that to the game? And then you'd see all this start, this interplay occur, all these other things are involved in it, and it sort of, that was when I really began to get deeper into the game.
In order to discuss the various specialties players have developed, you write about several different individuals, Dwight Howard and Ben Wallace as magnificent rebounders, for example, former Chicago Bulls player Steve Kerr as a pure shooter, and so on. But, of course, Steve Kerr had been retired as a player for 5 years when you approached him as the subject for that chapter. What did he think about the idea?
Yeah, Steve was a very good sport, let's put it that way. You know, he's always been media-friendly to a certain extent, and I think he saw a bit of a challenge in it. And my thesis was, okay, pure shooters are born. This is sort of an idea in basketball, and I wondered, okay, does it ever go away? So the idea with Kerr was, okay, let's pull him out of cold storage. He's been retired 5 years. You know, he tells me he doesn't even play basketball anymore. He plays a little bit of tennis. And I say, well, Steve, you know, would you be nice enough to engage me in this shooting contest so I could try to prove or disprove this theory?
So tell me how this shooting contest with Steve Kerr turned out.
There was one little moment of drama wherein we decided to shoot some college three-pointers, and then some NBA three-pointers, and then we were going to play horse. And the NBA one was probably the element I was most curious about how Kerr would perform, because that was his specialty. So we came out, and I hit 12 out of 25, which I figured was good enough for me. And Kerr starts shooting, and he misses three of his first six. And so at that point, you know, I got this sort of thought in the back of my mind, you know, maybe there's a chance here. Kerr proceeds to hit all but one of the rest of the shots. He hits 21 out of 25 NBA three-pointers, coming out cold, walked down from his office in tennis shoes. It was remarkable. I mean, that would win the NBA three-point shootout.
I was intrigued by your chapter about the free throw. I have never understood why guys who are paid millions and millions of dollars to play basketball don't work hard enough at foul shots to get good at them. Did you learn anything about that?
A tremendous amount. And I went into it with this same concept as you said, Bill. And I started talking to him. And there's a lot involved there. And a lot of it, I think, is based on pride. If you focused on that, it's not, you know, to an extent, it's not really sexy. And the amount of practice that it takes to be a very good free throw shooter, these guys practice 100 shots, 200 shots a day. You know, I met with this guy who holds a Guinness record, 2,750 in a row. And he did that as a retired podiatrist at age 71. So it's like, if he can do that, you know, why can't Dwight Howard hit 6 out of 10? And Dwight's an interesting case. He told me he hears it all. You know, you're at the game and you're in the third deck, you yell something, you figure no one ever hears you. Dwight hears you. And he says, I hear that guy in the third deck. So last year he actually started humming songs to himself, Beyonce songs, at the free throw line so that he wouldn't hear people yelling at him. He's so far in his own head. He's not a bad free throw shooter in practice, same as Shaq. These guys will hit 70, 80% in practice. They get out there, and suddenly all that physical ability that allows them to dominate, you know, power, strength, it's all gone, and it's all mental.
One of the interesting points you make when you write about defense is that a defensive player who holds a great scorer to 35 points may still have done a terrific job in that game, mm-hmm. as long as his team wins and those 35 points don't beat him.
Yeah, and they often judge it by how many shot attempts. So Battier, basically, Shane Battier of the Rockets, his equation is, if I can hold him to 1 point per shot, that's a good night for me. And that works on two levels. One is the field goal percentage. Let's say it's, you know, 25 points on 25 shots. That means the field goal percentage is probably not too good for that shooter, A. And B, it means he didn't get the line a lot. And free throws are the most efficient way to score in the NBA. If a guy scores 40 points, but it takes him 30-some shots to get there, the defender still says, well, they had to run all their offense through this guy. He probably wasn't creating for his teammates. He didn't get to the line. Chances are we probably won that game.
It was interesting to me that you began the book with a chapter discussing Kobe Bryant, who is without question a brilliant player. You especially praise his mindset and his determination to impose his will on the opposition. And even on his teammates, you talk about how he has to be the alpha male on the team. But did you consider including in your presentation of Bryant his adultery and the fact that a civil charge of rape was settled out of court?
It didn't seem relevant to a basketball conversation. I think from the perspective of probably what drove him, that was, you know, mildly relevant. And that would certainly fit into something that affected his off-the-court stuff. But I don't think it ever affected Kobe too much on the court. I think he was able to always be a basketball guy. I'm not one to judge Kobe as a human being, but I didn't write a chapter about him as a human being for obvious reasons. I think there are, you know, he's obviously a flawed person in ways that many athletes are, but that's almost an example of how effective he is at channeling his energy, that during that time period when he was on trial and it was all, you know, it was all over the media and he was flying back from that trial, he would still be so effective in games. I couldn't be that way. I mean, I don't know if that says anything good or bad about him, but it certainly says he's able to become totally obsessively focused on basketball.
I'm talking with Chris Ballard, author of The Art of a Beautiful Game, and you're listening to Only a Game. The final chapter of your book features LeBron James. No surprise there at all. He is widely regarded as the most dominant player in the game today. 70% of his colleagues in the NBA regard him that way. But But in the epilogue, you tell the story of a middle-aged mutual fund manager who beat Michael Jordan one-on-one. Tell us of the triumph of John Rogers Jr. and how his victory constituted art rather than luck.
Yeah, I love that. And in a very small sense, it perhaps undercuts everything that comes before in the book. John Rogers Jr. Is the head of Ariel Mutual Funds, very successful man, based out of Chicago. And he played at Princeton in the early 80s. But he doesn't look like a basketball player. You know, he's about 6'2". He's got the rec specs. You know, he's at that point where there's a brace on every part of his body. And he went to this Jordan flight camp, and this was a few years back here, and Jordan used to have this thing where he would play campers one-on-one, you know, to three baskets, and Jordan had apparently never lost. And Rogers, you know, doesn't look like much of a player. So as Jordan often does, he sort of let Rogers get a first shot off. And when Rogers hit a crazy shot, Jordan was like, good job, ha, ha, ha. And then Jordan was going to impose his will upon him with some jumpers. But then Jordan happened to miss a couple jumpers, and it comes down to the final point, and Rogers has the ball, and he drives left on Michael, and you can tell that Michael has now decided he's actually going to play defense. So when Rogers jumps up in the air, Michael jumps with him, and he's pretty much like an umbrella over him. He's got everything covered. There's no way Rogers is getting this shot off. And Rogers, you know, he tells me later, he's practiced this move his whole life. He does one of these, like, spinning lefty from the hip underneath scoop shots that hits almost like the top of the board and then spins in. And as he shoots it and hits it, you can hear Jordan screaming, "Oh, no!" And that's it. That's the first time Jordan loses. And it was just this wonderful moment. Actually, it's captured on video. And Rogers, you know, he ended up having copies, DVDs made for everyone he works for. And, you know, who can blame him kind of thing.
Chris Ballard is the author of The Art of a Beautiful Game, The Thinking Fan's Tour of the NBA, a Sports Illustrated book published by Simon & Schuster. And he joined me from UC Berkeley. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill. Come on.
What I live for? Basketball, beats and bras. From Italy to the U.S., yes, it's raw. I'm in search for the one that make my wealth feel poor. Who can ignore this spotlight life of glamour? Am I dumb for? Have I found the ore? Should I search still? There's plenty of women with sex.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last weekend, soccer fever grabbed Brazil during the final games of the national championship. While nearly everyone in Sao Paulo was watching the games, thieves broke into the vault of a cash delivery firm and delivered about $6 million to themselves. For months, the thieves had been digging a tunnel into the premises, but they waited until match day to make their withdrawal. A security guard working at the firm reported that he'd heard some loud noises but claimed he thought they were from fireworks lit by fans during the huge parties celebrating the triumph of Flamengo, the Rio de Janeiro team that ended up champion.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our annual celebration of sports-related gifts, just in time for your holiday shopping. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Gimme, Bill. Gimme, 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 gimme.
See, the Christmas spirit is alive and well in you. The defending Super Bowl champion Pittsburgh Steelers are 6-7 this season after quarterback Ben Roethlisberger was sacked 8 times in the team's loss to the lowly Browns on Thursday night. But hey, getting sacked 8 times is no big deal for a guy recovering from a concussion or 7, right?
This is a real mess in Pittsburgh right now. They're talking seriously about whether Mike Tomlin, who is not even a year removed from having won a Super Bowl, has any future coaching this team. The Browns are pathetic, and somehow the Steelers found a way to be even more pathetic.
Charlie, I did not know until this week that Hachi Go means 85 in Japanese, unless somebody is trying to put something over on the football player formerly known as Chad Ochocinco, in which case Hachi Go may mean I have no idea why I'm talking about changing my name yet again. Perhaps it's silly.
Apparently a Japanese film crew has talked him into it, that he's now going to do Hachi Go. There are how many languages left on the planet?
Plenty. Thousands.
He can change his name once a month from now on, as long as he gets back to 85.
In college football news, the BCS Bowl matchups were announced on Sunday. Any of them particularly thrill you?
Well, I think that the cowardly way the BCS has managed to match up Boise State and TCU, so none of the really important schools have to play those two undefeated squads, is pretty hilarious. Obviously, the national championship game has lost a little luster since Alabama looked so good and Texas looked so bad in their conference championship games. I'll be quite honest with you, there are a couple of very interesting bowl matchups. The Pacific Life Holiday Bowl, and I can't believe I just used the corporate sponsor, Arizona and Nebraska. Nebraska, of course, has my new favorite player, Mr. Su, whose first name in Cameroonian means House of Spears. How cool is that?
It's a lot better than 85.
Absolutely.
A subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives has moved on to the nation's most important business, the consideration of a college football playoff system. So how much mischief can they do in that realm?
Oh, I think they can do some mischief, but this is never going to happen. Sooner or later, people will adjourn for the holidays, having failed to do anything about health care and the various financial reforms necessary to get the country back on its feet. And I don't think they're going to be quite concerned about whether or not Utah gets another chance to play in a BCS game.
Notre Dame has a new head coach, appropriately named Kelly. Will the guy with a good Irish name help turn things around for the Fighting Irish?
I think he'll turn things around to the point where sometime in the next 3 or 4 years they'll probably make one of the big BCS bowl games. They're never going to win another national championship there, regardless of what their fans think. This guy's got a terrific resume. He really did a great job at Cincinnati. He's not going to coach Cincinnati in the Sugar Bowl, which I found fairly interesting. I guess Notre Dame wants him on the job as quickly as possible. And he's a graduate of Assumption College in Massachusetts, from Worcester in my hometown, which are known as the Greyhounds, by the way, should anyone ask.
Does that constitute another corporate sponsor? Or is that
I don't think
okay?
So. I think they're probably a nonprofit at this point.
Charlie, yesterday afternoon, Tiger Woods announced that he was temporarily suspending his golf career to concentrate on repairing his marriage. Lots of people may be tired of Tiger Woods news, and I understand that now commercial television is providing them an alternative to All Tiger All the Time.
Now's the time. I mean, it's interesting because he's not losing sponsors. He's just losing commercials, which is an interesting kind of way for these guys to play it to see how the overall fallout behind all the current nastiness goes. I will tell you, though, that there are still Tiger posters and advertisements up at places like Logan Airport and Atlanta Hartsfield Airport, and some of them, in light of current events, are pretty damn funny, let me tell you.
One of the most impressive coals in baseball's hot stove league, Curtis Granderson, is set to glow in New York on behalf of the Yankees next spring. No surprise, I suppose, at the most recent acquisition there.
I'm going to take just a second because I have to disentangle my feet from this metaphor. One moment, please. Yes, he's going to go play center field for the Yankees. This, says goodbye to Johnny Damon, probably. It's a move that shows the Yankees aren't done yet. It's a move that's going to scare the heck out of the Boston Red Sox. It does everything the Yankees want it to do.
Shaquille O'Neal said this week that his teammate LeBron James could coach in the NBA right now. Now, Mr. O'Neal has sometimes been known as the Big Aristotle. So, on his say-so, should we begin referring to Mr. James as the Big Alexander the Great?
I know, because Alexander was the pupil of Aristotle.
That's
who was
what
the
they
pupil
tell
of Plato. That would make Dale Brown Plato. And I've been to LSU, and I know Dale real well. He ain't no Plato, let me tell you. But given the performance of LeBron James' squad over the last week, I don't think LeBron James could coach LeBron James right now.
Is this metaphor more tortured than the one about the coals?
Oh, no, the previous one was waterboarded and hung by its wrists from the ceiling for a long time, I think.
All right, we have entered the part of the college basketball season where very good
teams people care about
are playing other very good teams. And on Wednesday night, number 4, Kentucky beat Connecticut, thus making a case for being ranked maybe just a little bit higher. What do you think?
Yeah, they will be. John Wall, their freshman, has been as advertised. He's a terrific player. He got 25, including 12 of the last 15. Who knows what John Calipari is doing behind the scenes down there? I would never suggest wrongdoing, of course, except to point out that the last two teams he coached both have had their performances in the NCAA tournament stricken from the record. But nevertheless, the Kentucky people seem happy.
Coincidence?
And they're a top 5. You be the judge.
Since you are Mr. NASCAR, it is only right and proper that I should seek out your opinion on the latest driver to sign on to the circuit, albeit part-time. That would be Danica Patrick, who will race in whichever NASCAR races don't conflict with her full-time IndyCar schedule. Good idea?
Well, it's a bit of a circus. The NASCAR people are probably half happy and half angry about this whole thing. I don't think she'll make much of a dent in NASCAR the first year, simply because of its visibility and the fact that it's run more coherently than IndyCar racing. She may wind up there full-time at some point, but I think this is a gimmick at this point.
Golfer John Daly is preparing to write a book, but is he running the risk that a lot of people may not recognize him when they look at his photo on the jacket?
He's lost 115 pounds, remarkably enough. I said, by the way, he saw Matt Damon, how he swung a golf club. He said if he wanted a movie made about him, he'd want Matt Damon to play John Daly. So he had to thin on down. He certainly has a story. I mean, I would buy a ticket for this particular saga. And I do like the fact that he was the one that came out first to talk about Tiger's, you know, problems, because if you're going to take advice from a guy about turning your private life into a public circus, who better than John Daly? Mm-hmm. The man has done it all.
Been there, done that. And finally, Charlie.
Sports!
Testing for performance-enhancing drugs is required for sports wishing to be included in the Olympic Games, but still, I am a little surprised by the new rules put into effect at the World Pie-Eating Championships. Would you care to explain?
Yeah, apparently pie eaters are known to cheat by lubricating their throats, usually with gravy, as it turns out. But now the really good thing to do is to use cough syrup because it partially anesthetizes your throat and lets the pie slip down. As Mr. Tony Callahan, the guy running the pie-eating contest, says, they're going to put a couple of big blokes on the door to search pockets randomly for cough mixture. And this is very close to being the single most disgusting story we've ever done on this show, because I don't want to think about guys pouring like a gallon of gravy down their throats and then eating 57 different pieces of pie.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It's time now for our mid-December assertion that it's never too late to acquire the perfect gift for the sports-oriented person on your list. And so we present the 17th annual Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Fixing and fixing an oldest reindeer, pulling on the reins.
We've such a surfeit of presents, some preposterous, some profound, that I'm going to get the overly burdened sports sled sliding without further delay.
I'm John Guzman, and I've published the Driveway Chef's Cookbook for the football season, a deep-frying cookbook. Got 68 recipes correlated to all the NFL football teams.
When I spoke with Mr. Guzman, he seemed especially enthusiastic about the Baltimore Ravens potato nest, which he'd whipped up to honor what is apparently one of his least favorite teams.
We tried to come up with the absolute worst thing for you. So we're like, okay, it's got to include bacon, it's got to include eggs, and it's deep fried, and there's got to be some cheese in it.
What about hemlock?
Haven't done that yet. I've read about it, but I haven't done that yet.
I had assumed Mr. Guzman had tried all his recipes, which led to my next question. What is your cholesterol count, and what count do you aspire to?
Well, you know, last time I checked, I usually check right at the beginning of the season, and I was normal. And I'm hoping at some point they're going to start just checking for blood, if there's any blood left.
The ultimate blood test. Is there any blood?
Yeah.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
After the consumption of all that deep-fried food, exercise is certainly in order. So we turned to Brad Latour, the inventor of Jump Snap, the ropeless jump rope.
There is a talking feature that will summarize your workout, and you can mute that if you find it annoying as well.
And does the talking feature ever say, "You are a klutz, you have just broken your leg"?
It does not. It does not.
Jump Snap, the jumpless jump rope, rope not included, ever, on purpose.
I really can't stay. Mama, it's cold outside. I've got to go away. I said it's cold outside.
Even in these days of worry about global warming, the weather over the holiday season tends to be chilly. This dismays Ira Cohen not in the least, since his product pretty much depends on chili.
We are the manufacturers of the only officially licensed college Snuggies in the world. We offer over 60 schools, and that number is growing every month.
Yeah, but I got to think Florida and California are out, right? We're talking about northeastern schools and midwestern schools, not schools in places where it's warm and who needs a Snuggie.
University of Florida and Florida State are actually number 3 and number 7 on the Snuggie list. People actually send us pictures of them wearing them in their house. I guess if the air conditioning is on too cold, or they'll make it. Maybe they purposely make it cold so they have a use to wear it.
Rich food and snuggly warmth may suggest the holidays to you, but where's the spirituality? Since spiritual and sports both start with S, the connection seems obvious, or at least it did to Denise Tiller of All About Him Rosaries and Religious Jewelry. I spoke with Ms. Tiller about a particular item combining the two passions.
The basketball rosary is composed of ceramic basketballs, as the Our Father beads, and then it has natural mahogany obsidian beads, as well as black agate and black onyx beads.
I asked Ms. Tiller to speculate on the popularity of the rosaries featuring basketballs and tokens of various other games, which her company began producing half a dozen years ago.
I think for younger kids, praying the rosary isn't exactly a cool thing to do. So if you're going to pray the rosary and you have to pull a rosary out of your pocket, I think they feel cool because they have something that's sports related.
Yeah, I got my rosary here, but look, it's got basketballs on it,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, no, but that's right, Bill. That's exactly right.
There is a football edition of this rosary, and I'm wondering, given the way things have gone in South Bend, Indiana this year, whether you've gotten orders to send great giant truckloads of football rosaries to Notre Dame.
I could only pray for that, Bill.
Happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah. Shalom Lechayim in Basel Tov.
Also available to fans looking to combine their enthusiasm for sports with emblems of their faith are the baseball caps offered by Jason Schiff of JewishSource.com. They are, like any other baseball caps, representative of whatever major league team you choose to support, except that the team names are rendered in Hebrew.
Like, you got the Boston, you got the red B in the back, the Cubs, you have the Cubs logo, Yankees, you have the NY. They make great gifts year-round. Hanukkah gifts, you know, just like a regular bar mitzvah gift, graduation gifts. You know, we sell a lot in the summertime, too.
Hark, now Harold's going to swing, after which his club he'll fling deep into the tule weeds as he curses rants and sees.
Fans of interactive games that don't have to be plugged in will enjoy the Miniature Book of Miniature Golf, which, as the title suggests, gives the armchair athlete an opportunity to tap a little golf ball around a nearly impossible course inside a book with a little plastic club. With author Mike Vago in my gallery, I scored 10 on the first hole, which is a par 5.
You got it?
I think I whiffed.
Oh, no.
For the sake of baseball fans with wall space to fill, Only a Game's crack gift guide mobile unit traveled to Somerville, Massachusetts recently to visit with Chris Speakman, who silkscreens posters featuring the images of various players and teams in the style of World War II propaganda prints. Think Uncle Sam Wants You. The posters have been gracing the walls of Dunkin' Donut shops across New England. He's also started doing some work for Topps, the baseball card company. As befits the holiday season, Speakman sounds like a guy who couldn't have received a better line of work as a gift.
I have in the back room more old ratty baseball cards than I know what to do with, and now I have my own. I'm actually creating more. It's humbling, really.
More bemused than humbled by what he's offering the gift-buying public is the purveyor of a particular product from the Tuber family.
My name's Dean Gorby, and I am the business development manager here at PPW Toys.
and we developed the NHL Mr. Potato Head. We wanted to kind of have some fun at the NHL's image of being one of the tougher sports, mm-hmm. which is why we developed him with a black eye and a missing tooth. Unfortunately, the NHL thought we were a little too violent, so we actually had to cut the black eye out of it.
As has been the case since the mid-60s, the contemporary version of Mr. Potato Head is plastic. No actual potatoes were harmed in his development. Not surprisingly, he's most welcome as a gift in cities where hockey is big, or where potatoes are big.
Interestingly, in Idaho, we do make a Boise State Mr. Potato Head. Even though Boise State is not one of the top-selling schools for most licensed product, our Boise State Mr. Potato Head, for obvious reasons, is one of our best-selling colleges.
Whether the sports fans on your list are in Idaho, New York, Chicago, Boston, Rancho Cucamonga, Cleveland, or Cuernavaca, whether they prefer basketball beads or double dips of delicious, albeit dangerous, deep fat fried delights, we hope the 17th edition of the Only a Game gift guide has been helpful. To find out where you can purchase any of this year's featured gifts or to discover even more sports gift ideas, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Happy holidays from all of us to all of you. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help this week from Jim Hockridge at UC Berkeley and from KXCV in Maryville, Missouri. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from John Guzman, author of The Driveway Chef's Cookbook, who responds to my concern that his diet of heavily fried foods was just bad news.
Well, the good news is most of the week my wife makes me eat broccoli and stuff, but on Sundays I really tear it up.
You can't deep fry that broccoli?
I've done that.
I'm Phil Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Mini, featuring the 37 miles per gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.